And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I am worried. No, not worried about the standard things you might think I'm worried about. You know, the fact that our economy's falling apart, the fact that it looks like it's in Congress, the Republicans are going to prevent a bailout of the auto industry, a bridge loan, so to speak, because, well, let's face it, they haven't attacked workers enough. And you know what? They're too energy efficient, two things that Republicans clearly don't like. We'll get into that. And no, you might think I'm worried about what's going on in Illinois or even Caroline Kennedy in New York. I'm not. But we'll talk about that, too. Or you might think I'm worried about what damage Bush can do in his last 40 days. Sure, I'm worried about that. I'm also worried about pardons. But that's not the thing that's most on my mind right now. What's most on my mind as a resident of metropolitan Washington, D.C., is the inaugural crush. What's going to happen on Tuesday, January 20th, when I and, 4 million of my fellow American citizens all joined together on the National Mall in the largest celebration in American history. What will probably be, I need to, I guess, look at some records here. I know it will be the largest public gathering in all of Washington, D.C.'s history. I suspect it may be the largest public gathering in all of American history. I'll do some research on that. Some 4 million people are expected to crowd in for Barack Obama's inaugural celebration, to hear his swearing in, to watch the parade, that is, if we can move, packed wall-to-wall human beings. And I'm concerned. I'm concerned about security. I'm concerned about transit. I'm concerned about medical needs for all of those people. I'm concerned about how all these people are going to relieve themselves if necessary. I'm concerned about whether or not there's enough money for this thing. Now, you know, I really hope that all my concerns are just Pollyanna. But it's better to be prepared than to, to cry about spilt milk later. So I would far rather that all of my concerns end up to be nothing. That all of the 93 or so law enforcement officials that are going to be there, I don't mean law enforcement officials, I mean law enforcement agencies, police officers from all across the country, not just Virginia and Maryland, but Pennsylvania, probably most of the East Coast. I hope that they're all going to be there. I hope that the Metro, D.C. subway, will work to carry in the millions of us in and out. I'm very, very concerned about that. I hope that all goes out without a pinch and that everyone focuses on January 20th on Barack Hussein Obama. And, yes, he's going to use his middle name. We'll talk about that, too. By the way, it's something I support. I hope they'll all be focusing on our new president and his vision for the future and drawing America together and the historic day when at least a half-black man is elected president of the United States. I hope that is the focus. But I'm concerned, and mark my words, like I said, I'd rather be wrong in this prediction, but I'm concerned that the focus will not be on Obama, but on the crush, on the millions of people crowded into the Metro like sardines that God forbid would have an accident, on the fear that we won't have enough emergency services available for the crowd. And if it snows, if it's slushy, I'm really worried. The federal government gave the government of the District of Columbia $15 million to handle all of the needs of the inauguration. $15 million. To give you an idea of how that compares, in 2005, the last inauguration, the re-inaugural of George W. Bush, the federal government gave more money, $17.3 million, of a good 15% more. At that, I don't know if we should call it a celebration or not, I guess the people there were celebrating. Some 300,000 people attended. Barack Obama's celebration is likely to be at least 10 times the size of George Bush's celebration. So did Congress give 10 times the money? Oh, no. No. They gave 15% less. 15% less for 10 times the problem. And it's not just a problem of the huge numbers of people. The security issues are huge. there were no known threats, at least none that I'm aware of, to assassinate George W. Bush at his second inaugural. There are countless threats to kill Barack Obama. It's not something that people like to talk about, you know. But I have from very good sources that a number of groups, particularly racist groups, want to make sure that a black president never takes office. So the threat on that day is great. Indeed, it is likely to be the greatest that Obama has ever faced. Right now, he's in a fairly secure location. They know where he is in Chicago. He's not talking to a lot of people, a lot of strangers. He's passed the campaign. And frankly, once he enters the White House, ironically, the threat to him, while still larger, certainly, than the current inhabitant of the White House, will diminish a good deal. Something weird. The racists never want to see a black man become president, but it appears, from what I understand, that once he becomes president, once we have an African-American president, this idea, I guess, for the racists, that we can never have an African-American president goes away, and the threat, while still substantial, diminishes greatly. So there is a security threat. There is a threat from all the people that are there. There is a transportation threat. There is a hotel threat. There's a question of where they're going to park all the buses. And you know what, friends? I'm going to be in the middle of it all. Wouldn't miss it for the world. I will be crushed up against my fellow Americans in the National Mall. I don't care if it's raining, sleeting, snowing. I don't care what. I'm going to be there. I'm not going to miss this historic moment. Maybe you will be there, too. Now, whether I'll get inaugural tickets or not, I don't know. A lot of people are fighting for those. I guess the purpose of those inaugural tickets is that you get to see a very small figure, Barack Obama, give a speech. But frankly, many of us can simply watch on the Jumbotrons out in the mall. The inaugural, which has been ever since 1981 on the west front of the Capitol, that's the side of the Capitol that faces the huge National Mall, large rectangle of green that you probably have heard about that stretches from the Capitol to the Washington Monument and beyond, if necessary, to the Lincoln Memorial. That is where Ronald Reagan decided in 1981 to have the inauguration. Prior to that, it had been on the other side of the Capitol where there's far more limited space. Okay, kudos to Ronald Reagan. That's one thing he did right. We will likely fill the National Mall. If the so-called Million Men March, no one believes a million men or women showed up. I guess it was just men, right? Farrakhan only wanted men. But a million did not show. It was still a substantial crowd. When we think of crowds in Washington, of course, we think of Martin Luther King's March on Washington. But probably the largest gathering in Washington, D.C. history occurs on July 4th. Every July 4th, in fact. And Metro and other security officials are well prepared to deal with that. I have gone to the mall every July 4th, I think, since I moved to Washington 7 years ago. And I must say they're pretty good at it. They get people in and out pretty quickly. They get hundreds of thousands of people in and out, both in cars, and more importantly, on the Metro. They get us in through security, and they have to say they do a pretty good job. But that's 200, 300,000 people. Inauguration Day will be 10 times that amount. And whereas on a typical July 4th, people come at all times, I myself make a whole day of it, come early, this time everyone's going to need to be in place by at least 11:30. Barack Obama is sworn in precisely at noon, according to the Constitution. It wasn't always so good this July 4th. The largest crowd in Washington history on the mall was on July 4th, but it was on July 4th, 1976, at the bicentennial of the nation's founding. And at that time, which, let's admit it, at that time, public transportation, the metro, the subway system was just in its infancy. At that time, there were people that watched the fireworks at 9:30 p.m. and weren't able to leave the city by car until 4 a.m. The 6.5-hour traffic jam is the longest in American history. But you know what? They got a million people on the mall. And that's without much of a metro. There were just a few lines at the time. Can we do four times that? Can we? With as little money as Congress has appropriated? I don't know how Congress plans to make the people of the District of Columbia any poorer, any weaker. Of course, you Americans, in your wisdom, have denied the residents of the District of Columbia the right to have a seat in Congress. Okay, I know the horn audience hasn't done that, but certainly the Constitution has. Poor Eleanor Holmes Norton, the D.C. non-voting delegate, is elected every year just like a member of Congress, but she's just a mouthpiece. She doesn't get an actual vote, not to mention that there's no representation in the Senate. Maybe that's why D.C. gets put upon year after year after year. But this has got to be the worst. To appropriate more money for a re-election of a hack president than you do with the new election of a very well-loved president is beyond ridiculous. Heck, it borders on the criminal. And I do not want to hear all the postmortems on January 21st, January 22nd, when everyone should be focusing on Barack Obama and getting his team in place and the first things he does in his first days. I don't want to hear the postmortems about people that have died, whether by hypothermia or security threats or people being trampled, God forbid, or crushed in a metro car. These problems are foreseeable, and I'm warning you now. Remember all the people that said going into Iraq, they said, well, you know, these things, it wasn't foreseeable that the Iraqi people wouldn't want to be occupied. We were sure they would love occupation. We feel that people always love occupation. We never thought they'd become anti-American. Well, you thought they were ridiculous to say that then, but even more ridiculous saying that now. And yet people aren't talking about this problem. Maybe President-elect Obama needs to put his weight on this. But $15 million? When there are inaugural crowds, first of all, it is a truism to note that the inaugural crowd of a newly elected president is always greater than the re-election. It's just a fact. It makes sense. People were more excited in 92 with Bill Clinton than they were in 96. In 2000, I was at that inauguration, not to praise George W. Bush, but to join the massive protest against him. The largest inaugural protest in American history, one that got virtually no press. But when lots of angry Americans, Democrats and Republicans and independents, were incensed by the fact that the Supreme Court did a coup d'etat to put George Bush into office, even though Americans voted for Al Gore, both in the popular vote and in the electoral vote, since the majority of Floridians voted for him. I was angry. I came all the way from Los Angeles. I was so angry. And they put us in a very small area to protest. I remember it well. It was a very cold day, bone-chilling kind of cold day. And there was sleet and ice. It was one of those days where if it had been 28 degrees, it would have been much better than the 32.5 degrees it was. Because snow, frankly, freezes you less than freezing rain. We were shuttled in a very small area, we protesters, and I remember the guy next to me, well, not next to me, a few persons down with the urine he was going to throw at the president. He was arrested. And the guy with the egg he was going to throw at the president, I think he succeeded. He may have been arrested, I'm not sure. We were angry, and I don't advocate throwing things at a presidential barricade, let's be clear, but I understood the anger. And in fact, during that time, when George Bush's limousine came close to our area, they practically floored it. I remember the Secret Service agents who were walking behind had to break into a run to catch up. No, he was not happy to be in front of us, and we were not happy to have him in front of us. But you know what? There was a larger crowd in 2000 than in 2004. Both the celebrants of George Bush and those of us opposing it, and by the way, I should note, that those of us opposing that inauguration were 2-1 for those supporting it. I'm sure that's never happened before in American history, where you have more protesters at inauguration than celebrants. 2000 was indeed a year to remember, and the 2001 inauguration was a time to remember. But whatever it was, there was a much larger crowd in 2001 than in 2005. Only 300,000 people showed up in 2005. I didn't go. What's the point? I attended, in fact, a counter-inauguration ceremony a few miles away in another part of D.C., spoke there. But at that ceremony, for security, for transit, for crowd control, Congress appropriated, the Republican Congress appropriated $17.3 million. Bush signed it into law. This year, less. Less! $15 million. And this is a story that nobody's reporting that I've seen. Very few. Less money. And there's not going to be 300,000, my friends. There's going to be 3 million. I mean, I don't know. I haven't talked to 3 million people. It may only be 1 million. As noted, that's the largest crowd ever, about 1.2 million in 1976 at the bicentennial. But people are predicting 4 million. 4 million people. More than 10 times the 300,000 that attended George W. Bush's second inauguration. And D.C. has less money to handle it. To give you an idea, Congress has appropriated $15 million for the inaugural. They appropriated $50 million to the Democratic Convention at Denver and $50 million to the Republican Convention in St. Paul. $50 million, 5-0, rather than 15, more than three times the amount. For what? Okay, I'm sure John McCain and Sarah Palin had some security needs, and I'm sure a few people went to hear that in St. Paul. What, 100,000? Was it even that much? I don't think it was. At Invesco Field, where I was in Denver, Obama had some 75,000-85,000 people. A good crowd, to be sure, and probably 4 to 5 to 6 times what the Republicans had. Yet the Republicans and Democrats each got $50 million. But what's going to happen at the inauguration? Not 75,000 people, but 50 times that amount. At least 3.5 million. So it's 50 times that amount. I can do the math. 50 million times 50, let's see, that would be $250 million. No, it would be $2.5 billion. That's right. If 50 million is appropriate for 75,000 people, then maybe 2.5 billion, is that right? Yeah, it is. That's 50. Will be appropriate for 4 million people. I don't know. But we need a lot more than the paltry 15 million that Congress has appropriated. So I sure hope I'm wrong. Maybe people will give in kind. Maybe all those police officers will work for free. I can't imagine it. Who would work for free? But how are they going to raise the money to take care of all of us? I really fear it's an accident waiting to happen. Meanwhile, all the hotel rooms in D.C. are full. If you want to come here for the inauguration, you better have a good friend. There's some 95,000 hotel rooms in the full metropolitan Washington, D.C. area. Every one of them is full. People are looking online. I know friends of mine who are selling their homes on Craigslist for a week. Some going prices, believe it or not. One of them, I guess it's a nice home, $14,000 for a week. Hey, it's a tough economy. I can understand those D.C. residents. They're making a very quick buck, a lot of money, and they're getting the heck out of town. Not me. I could probably make a nice sum. My house isn't too far from a metro stop. I'm not too far from D.C., from the mall. Heck, in the metro in a normal time, you can get there in maybe 20 minutes. But not me. I'm not going to miss it. Although I got to tell you, I got a bunch of friends who have said, "Hi, Mark, we haven't heard you, talked to you in such a long time. How you doing? You going to be in D.C. for January 20th? I got friends from California. Lots of people have become my friend. It's amazing how that works. You may have the same issue. And yes, we'll have the military there. And yes, we'll have 93 law enforcement agencies. I remember seeing them in 2000. Cops from not just Virginia and Maryland and D.C., but Pennsylvania as well. But how the heck are they going to do it? According to the Washington Post, if you just take the tour buses, just take the number of tour buses coming into the District of Columbia for the inauguration ceremonies, and you were to line them up end to end, they would go all the way around the 64-mile Washington Beltway and stretch an additional 45 miles to Baltimore. That's a lot of buses. How do you even fit them in the District of Columbia, which is, you know, it's no more, it's what, about 6 square miles? Let's see. It was ten, it used to be 10 by 10 on each side till Virginia got its half back. I don't know. Maybe it's 70 square miles. I'd have to figure it out. It ain't that big. And buses that stretch all the way around the Washington Beltway and up to Baltimore, end to end, where are you going to put them all? How are they going to get across the bridges? I hope they come in the night before. And then there's the metro. Wait, that's how I'm going to get there. I have not dare driving in on Inauguration Day. There's the metro. So what time should I get in the car, the metro car? 6 a.m.? I'm told if I get in at 6 a.m., I'll never make it. It should be 5 a.m. or 4 a.m. Yikes. The metro cars are designed to hold 140. Apparently, they can hold 160 with relatively discomfort. Many people think that some 300 will be crammed into the cars. I hope the fire marshal isn't there to prevent some kind of overcrowding situation, and yet maybe he or she should be. What if somebody passes out? Yikes. And then the weather? I mean, I don't mean to give you a doomsday scenario, but I'm really concerned here. What about the weather? What if there is snow or sleet? It is January 20th, for God's sake. January 20th. That's the middle of winter. And yes, we do get some pretty ugly slush and sleet, and then people are going to be in their coats. What if it's raining or sleeting or snowing and people have umbrellas that can stick into everybody? How are we all going to fit in those little metro cars? And what if one of them has an accident, as they sometimes do in the snow? Am I scaring you enough yet? I would not want to be in charge of handling this. What if there's a medical emergency? How the heck will an ambulance get to the mall? It'll be impossible. I even wonder about the porta potties. How are 4 million people going to relieve themselves? I mean, it's not even like you can relieve yourself outdoors when there are 4 million people around. Not much privacy. But you know what? Despite all of this, despite all the people I know in Washington, D.C., in the metropolitan area who are running away, getting as far out of town as possible, renting their house at Craigslist and other places for thousands of dollars. By the way, apparently you can get at least $500 a night just for a little basement apartment for sleeping on the floor. Part of me says I should take up on this, that it's easy money, that easy money doesn't happen very often. But you know what? I'm not. I'll tell you why I'm not. I'm not because I feel like every American should have a chance to witness this day. And my friends, and even my acquaintances, who I haven't talked to in a long time, who want to come to Washington, I'm pretty much allowing anybody who wants to come. Oh, God, that's a dangerous thing to say right here on the radio. I'm going to have a lot of people knocking on my door. Well, if you want to come in, you want to sleep on my floor, go ahead. Because every American should have a right to witness this day. And yes, there'll be a crush, and yes, it'll be crazy, and yes, logistics are horrendous. But you know what? When I'm going to be out there on that mall with 4 million of my fellow American citizens, you know, I'll be touching probably 20 of them at the same time. I suspect we'll be crowded in like sardines. I may not be able to get inaugural tickets. I don't really care. Frankly, I'm much more focused on getting a job with the Obama administration than getting the tickets to get me ever so closer. I'll probably just be out in the mall watching those big Jumbotron screens. Frankly, those of you at home will have a better shot, so I'm going to tape it all on TV. I just want to be there with my fellow Americans, watching history happen, watching a change from the worst president in my lifetime and one of the worst presidents in American history to a man who I think has every possibility of being one of the best. To be there among all those hopeful people, you know what? If it's 10 degrees outside, I like to think that all my fellow Americans will keep me warm. And not just with body heat, but with hope. I'm excited to be there for all the horrifics of the logistics. Like I said, I ain't in charge of them, and I'm glad I'm not. Somehow I think it'll all work out. One of the reasons I'm sounding the alarm now, though, is because people should sound the alarm. If you could call your member of Congress and ask he or she to appoint a little bit more money for D.C., we could use your help. Because Washington, D.C. is not just a city. The District of Columbia is not just a geographic area. We are, like it or not, your nation's capital. And we are doing this on behalf of the entire nation. Obviously, President Obama will be President of the United States of America, not of the District of Columbia. So we need your help in sponsoring this national event, and I, for one, will plea on behalf of residents of Washington, D.C. to call your member of Congress. They're not getting anything accomplished right now with the car bill and everything else. I'm going to talk about that in the second half of the hour. But if you could call your member of Congress and ask them to please provide enough money for D.C., and they may say we are, and remind them that you're giving $15 million, which is less than a third of the $50 million they gave the conventions, where 1/50th of the people attended in the Democratic Convention, 1/100th. There's a big difference between the 10,000 people in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the 4 million likely to attend on the National Mall. It's about 400 times the difference. Again, check my math. Help us out. Tell your member of Congress to give a little bit more money to D.C. I do not want the story to be, after the inauguration, a story of the logistics. I want the logistics problems to be on page A7 of your newspaper, not page A1. On A1, the focus should be on President Obama, Vice President Biden, and the 4 million cheering throngs, hopeful that finally, America will have a change. Finally, we'll have a president who will dig us out of the shambles left over from the worst administration in American history. As for the rest of that, as for those shambles of presidential pardons, what's going on with the auto bill, and what's going on in Illinois as well. we'll get to all of that right after the break. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. The horrifying jobless stats that just came out should shake up even the most ardent free marketeers. 573,000 people filed for unemployment claims last week, a 26-year high. So, too, the total number of people collecting unemployment today, almost 4.5 million. And it's likely, as Obama said, to get worse. All because of greed. All because the banks were screwing around with fancy, unregulated financial instruments. All because Bill Clinton, Robert Rubin, Lawrence Summers, Alan Greenspan, George Bush, Ben Bernanke, and Hank Paulson gave them the green light to do so. The lesson here is obvious. The free market doesn't work if left to its own devices. This was the confessed flaw in Alan Greenspan's theory, kind of like the inventor of the Hindenburg confessing to a little flaw after the explosion. No solace for the victims. Fortunately, Obama knows what needs to be done. We need a huge government stimulus plan. Unfortunately, that won't happen for at least another 6 weeks. So we're likely to have 6 more weeks of 500,000 people or more filing for unemployment claims. They can't wait, we can't wait, for Bush to go. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right.
We do?
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at CityNet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit CityNet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I am concerned about the logistics in D.C. One thing I'm not concerned about is Barack Obama. So far, I've been very impressed with how he's handled practically everything. Now, I don't mean to be a Pollyanna, and I don't mean to suggest the man is perfect, and no, I don't have the Messiah complex. Thank you for asking. But I got to say, I'm very impressed with this guy. I mean, I liked Bill Clinton, too, but you know, we all know what happened when Bill Clinton came to office, and he was forced immediately to compromise on things like don't ask, don't tell, on things like Hillary Clinton's health care reform. Part of it was, let's face it, Congress. And one of the nicest things that Barack Obama has is he has a Democratic Congress that is very supportive of him. We have 58 or 59, depending on what happens in Minnesota. I think we've got a really good shot of winning Minnesota. As you recall, I predicted we'd lose Georgia, but I predicted we'd win Minnesota. I'd like to have my prediction be true. If it is, then I will have gotten every Senate seat right, not to brag. But I also got every electoral vote right except for Missouri. I predicted Missouri would go for Barack Obama, and it was the closest state that he lost. But other than that, I got every state right. I got to brag a little. I even guessed the Nebraska electoral vote from Omaha going to Barack Obama. So with the exception of the Show Me State, they just ruined my perfect record. Anyway, if we win in Minnesota, then I'll have a perfect record there, too, in the Senate. But the point is that this is a Congress that is, I think, very anxious to be behind Barack Obama. In fact, he largely helped get a lot of them elected. And it is, without a doubt, the most progressive Congress probably since the time of the New Deal, when, let's face it, it was a very different kind of progression then. But if you look at the last time the Democrats had this much power in Congress, you have to look under Jimmy Carter, and that was a very, very different Democratic Party. We did have a slightly greater majority in 1977 and 78, but at that time, the Democratic Party still consisted of a bunch of the old-line Democrats. You know, the Democrats that represented the Confederate South, the Democrats that were left over, if you will, from the time when the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln, the party who freed the slaves. The Republican Party used to be the party of Teddy Roosevelt, our first progressive president. And the Democrats, while they looked out for the poor, the Democrats have always looked out for the poor, really, ever since Andrew Jackson. As much as Andrew Jackson was horrific, committing genocide against Native Americans, he did look out for poor white men in a way that, let's face it, people before him didn't look out for poor white men. In any case, the Democratic Party has always looked out for the poor, but in the early 1970s and the late 1970s, when we had more seats than we do today, the Democratic Party was still very much looking out for white Southerners. And I certainly wouldn't call it progressive. Now, many of those Democrats became Republicans, Strom Thurmond leading the way. Richard Shelby of Alabama remains, he remains the only senator. Yeah, I think it's fair to say. I think he's the only senator left that was a former Democrat that turned Republican when the Democrats became the party of civil rights and he switched sides. The point is that while Jimmy Carter had a Democratic majority, he had a lot of problems in the 70s holding that majority together. Northern liberals and Southern conservatives did not work very well together. And many of those Southern conservative Democrats were still left over, let's face it, when Bill Clinton took power. I will never forgive Sam Nunn of Georgia for putting in the horrific Don't Ask, Don't Tell law that remains the law to this day. Because, Sam Nunn said, he couldn't stand the fact that a gay person might be in a shower next to him. Insecure, are we, Sam, about our body image? I don't know. But that Democratic Party is gone. Out the window. When you look at our most conservative Democrats today, you think of people like, Joe Lieberman, who is very conservative on foreign issues, but mostly related to the past, mostly relating to the war with Iraq. He's lost on that. The American people have voted. Barack Obama has voted. And despite his apostasy, his betrayal, his attack on Barack Obama, and his support of John McCain, he's largely with us on the issues. On domestic issues, he's largely there, whether it's Social Security or unions or gay rights or the environment or teachers. Joe Lieberman's largely with us. He may be a jerk, but his vote is generally on our side. And now that foreign policy won't matter so much, because Congress has more than a majority to do whatever Barack Obama wants in Iraq, his vote will matter a lot less. And that's the most conservative member in the Democratic coalition. There's Ben Nelson of Nebraska, a state, a very red state, though, as I noted, Omaha, Nebraska went for Barack Obama. He's pretty conservative for a Democrat. He, in fact, votes much more closely with Republicans than Joe Lieberman does. But frankly, his votes aren't so different from Olympia Snowe or Susan Collins. And everyone else is better. I mean, who do we have left? There's good old Robert Byrd of West Virginia, whose time as the longest senator in American history is about to end. The guy is over 90. He probably won't live that much longer. Not that I wish him ill. I certainly recognize that he's got an awful past, being in the West Virginia Ku Klux Klan, but I also recognize that he has repudiated that past again and again. He's actually not so good on gay rights either. But that's the worst we have to worry about? I mean, Bob Byrd, for all the amount of appropriations and every road and byway and statue and home and community center in West Virginia named after him, he's not so bad. He's not so bad. When you think about it, if Byrd and Nelson and Lieberman are the worst in the Democratic coalition, I'm not that worried. And we also have, I think, people like Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins, Arlen Specter, a number of moderate Republicans who, when push comes to shove, will likely come our way. I would love to see, by the way, Arlen Specter take a job in the Obama administration and have Governor Rendell of Pennsylvania appoint a Democrat in his place. Arlen Specter suffers from cancer. He, I doubt, will run again. And that's another Democratic seat we can pick up. So while I'm pessimistic about the logistics of the inauguration, I'm optimistic about the future. And nowhere will the numbers in the Senate matter more than on the debate going on right now on the auto bridge loan. Frankly, I think it's a bad idea to call it the bailout bill. It's not really a bailout, friends. I mean, it's not as much of a bailout as the $700 billion we gave the financial industry. It's a bridge loan. And when you think about it, $15 billion divided by $700 billion. I'm doing a lot of math on the show today. Let's see here. That's 1/50th? 2% to save auto manufacturing in this country? Save 5 million jobs? I don't know how many Americans work in the financial services industry, but, it may be 5 million. Is it? I don't know. But it's not 50 times the numbers that work in the auto industry. Because it's not just the people who make the cars, right? It's the dealers. I had a guy, a dealer on my show just a few days ago. It's the people who sell the spare parts. It's the mechanics in the garages. It's, let's face it, the backbone of our economy. And people who work in the auto industry, it's going to be harder for them probably to change jobs than people who work in the financial industry who can, you know, shuffle from one thing to another. And yet, it appears at this moment that the current lame duck Congress is about to deny funds to the auto industry. Now, you heard me on my show. It's not like I'm in any way discounting the incredible mistakes made by the management of these auto companies. Yes, I recognize that 30 years ago, they should have developed hybrids back again from the Carter era. They should have developed cars with higher CAFE standards, higher fuel mile efficiency standards. I recognize that. No one is defending the management of the car companies. But 5 million workers in the midst of a recession? And what are the differences between the Republicans and the Democrats on this bill? I want you to focus on this here because the House of Representatives, controlled by the Democrats, has already passed the bill. However, it's likely to fail in the Senate. Now, I think come January 3rd, we can get with our new Democratic Senate of 58 or 59 members, we can then pass the bill and get over Republican filibuster. But GM tells us, General Motors tells us that if they don't get the money by the end of this month, they're going to go out of business. Now, I don't know if that's true. It may be an exaggeration to try to get the money now. But do you know why the Republicans in the Senate are turning against the bill? Do you know why Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, has declared that he is against the bill and why Republicans are falling in line? What do you think are the two reasons, the two biggest reasons, most awful reasons you can imagine why Republicans would be against a bridge loan to America's largest manufacturing industry? What would be the reasons? Would it be the failures that I mentioned to develop hybrids and fuel-efficient cars? No. Would it be the fact that the golden parachutes and that the management took corporate jets at least the first time they came to Washington? No, no, no. The Republicans are mad at the auto bridge loan bill for two reasons. Prepare yourself. One is it doesn't make workers suffer enough in the midst of the greatest depression since the Great Depression. And the other is the bill is too stringent in requiring the car manufacturers to be fuel efficient. They want us to be less efficient. So at a time of Great Depression, Republicans are saying you've got to make workers suffer more and you've got to indebt us to Saudi Arabia, China, and Venezuela more. I wish I were joking. I wish I were joking. But Mitch McConnell and the Republicans who have turned out against the bill, and I got to tell you, my friends, it doesn't look good. It looks like they're going to filibuster it. It looks like they're going to vote it down. Their first and primary concern is it doesn't punish workers enough. The Democrats are reluctant to take the unionized workers and to dock their wages, to remove the pensions of the guys and women who've already worked for 30, 40, 50 years on the assembly line and have retired, to take the money out of their pensions, which, if you ask me, shouldn't even be a question. It's their money. It belongs to them. They've done their good. They've worked. Why should they suffer now? To take the money from the pensions of people who are struggling at a time of Great Depression, to take middle class and lower middle class and people on the borderlines of poverty and make their lives worse, Democrats are opposed. But Republicans are insisting that the unionized workers suffer more. Now, it ain't their fault. They made none of the decisions to go to the Hummers and the heavy metals and the expensive gas-guzzling cars of the 80s and 90s and O's. But they're the ones Republicans want to punish. And they've laid down the gauntlet. Make the worker suffer, or we're going to filibuster the bill. Because we hate workers. We hate American workers. They don't fund our campaigns. We only love the plutocrats. We are the party of inherited wealth, the party of dividends and capital gains and estates. We are the party of the noble class. If you go back to Great Britain and France, we believe that you should never have to work, and people who get their hands dirty working, well, they should suffer. The only way to make money in Republican America is to be born into it. The caste system. If you are not born of nobility, well, then you were born to serve. And despite the fact the unions caused none of the problems, it's the Republicans that insist that those executives get to keep their golden parachutes and bonuses and such. But if the government's going to lend them the money, even though labor costs are 10% of the cost of a car, that's right, you go in, you buy your Saturn, it costs $25,000. If all workers were paid free and no workers, past workers, got their pensions, it would still cost you $22,500. Republicans want to punish the workers. And the other thing they want to punish, and again, I kid you not, I think the irony is just severe. You know, many, you couldn't joke about this. They believe that the fuel efficiency standards that the House wants to put in, the Democrats want to put in, are too stringent. That's right. Republicans want to make sure that the Humvees can still be produced, that cars that get 10 miles to the gallon can still be made, that we can continue to fall farther and farther behind the Japanese and the Europeans. You know, if Al-Qaeda were to infiltrate our legislature and vote to harm the American people, the American economy, and our future, could they choose a better representative than Mitch McConnell and the Republican leadership in the Senate? I mean, making sure that poor Americans suffer would not only destroy their lives, it would destroy our economy. 5 million jobs. Henry Ford was an anti-Semitic bastard, but he was right. If you don't pay workers enough to afford his Model Ts, the whole economy goes downhill. I mean, how many yachts can Dick Cheney buy? How much caviar can Paris Hilton eat? At some point, it has to trickle down to those that make under $1 million. It has to trickle down to those that make $30,000 and $40,000 and $50,000 a year. It has to trickle down to a worker on the assembly line who worked hard, who played by the rules, and who's getting hosed. Luckily, and not a moment too soon, I am not just counting the 40 days. I'm not just counting the 40 days from today until Barack Obama becomes President of the United States. I'm counting the mere 23 days until a Democratic Congress takes over. I don't know if General Motors can last till December 31st, but if it can last till January 4th, 4 days longer, the day after the Democratic Congress convenes, the strong Democratic Congress convenes, I'm hopeful that we can pass a real bill on January 3rd. And President Bush has indicated he'll sign it. Now, you know, he's put a few stringents on it. He's not as bad, frankly, as the congressional Republicans. He wants to make sure the money comes out of protecting fuel efficiency. George Bush, like most Republicans, believes that we have to be addicted to oil for life, that we should not in any way promote solar or wind or electric cars or fuel cells or any of the futuristic techniques. We've got to make sure we funnel more money into the companies that give so much money to Republicans, the oil companies. But George Bush has said that if the money comes from alternative energy sources, as long as wind suffers and solar suffers and fuel cells and energy cells suffer, he'll allow the bailout. And you know what? That's fine. Because we can replenish those funds come January 20th, when a real president, a president supported by the American people, comes to office. But I expect the car bill to fail. I hope it doesn't. But I expect it to fail. Maybe Americans have had bailout. They're just tired. They're just tired of too many bailouts. But this bridge loan, this really should go through. Whatever you thought about the financial bailout, this is 1/50th the price. With just as important, indeed, an even more important workforce, people who are on the cusp of keeping their homes and losing them. This one really should pass. And if the Republicans are going to filibuster it, then I think Harry Reid needs to make them do the old-fashioned filibuster. Make them go through Christmas Day. I mean it. Keep the Senate open. Make them keep talking. You know, today the way the filibuster works is people just say they intend to filibuster, and then usually the majority leader says, okay, since you intend to filibuster and we don't have 60 votes, the bill fails. But Harry Reid can make them go the old-fashioned way. Make a Republican stand in the Capitol throughout Christmas and speak and speak and speak and speak on why it is that American workers should suffer more, on why it is that our environment should be more polluted, on why it is that we should give more tax money to oil companies and less to alternative clean energy. Okay, I'm dreaming. They won't do that because the way a filibuster works is when they stop speaking, you have to be able to take a vote, and they're not going to come in over Christmas to vote. But it's a dream. I can dream it. Meanwhile, while the Republican Congress screws over American workers, George Bush looks for ways to whitewash his crimes. I fear, and I predict, that George W. Bush will take his commutation of Scooter Libby and make it into a full pardon. Not because the $250,000 fine means anything to an extremely rich man like Scooter Libby, but because George Bush wants to whitewash the whole damn thing. And I want you to think about the fact that U.S. Attorney Peter Fitzgerald, the same U.S. attorney that is putting a lot of pressure on Governor Rod Blagojevich for his bribery schemes. And on that note, I should make clear, obviously I support Blagojevich's resignation as soon as possible. But it's interesting to me the difference between Fitzgerald's indictment of Scooter Libby and his indictment of the sitting Illinois governor. In his indictment of Rod Blagojevich, Fitzgerald made clear that no one in the higher echelons of power knew anything about the sordid schemes of the corrupt Illinois governor. Barack Obama didn't know. In fact, you heard Blagojevich, well, you didn't hear him, you read the transcripts of his tapes in the indictment where he said that mofo, that's the word he used, talking about our president-elect. Well, he didn't use that. He used the real word that was bleeped in the transcript. But he said that Obama, if Blagojevich gave Obama his chosen candidate, his friend Valerie Jarrett in Illinois, and made her the senator from Illinois, Obama offered him nothing but effing appreciation. Maybe I should say bleeping appreciation. Or as Blagojevich put it, bleep that. And yet, that is the Barack Obama I know and I expected. He would not trade anything. He would not pay to play. He would not accept or give a bribe. Compare Fitzgerald, the same prosecutor's treatment of Blagojevich with his treatment of Scooter Libby, where he made clear that Scooter Libby had specifically obstructed justice so as to protect the Vice President of the United States from, and this is my word, not his, treason. Fitzgerald pointed out that Scooter Libby had allowed a cloud to appear over the vice president's office. And let me suggest to you this wasn't a white fluffy cloud. It was a menacing rain cloud, thunderstorm. We all know what Scooter Libby did. He took the fall. He did what Haldeman and Ehrlichman and all of the president's men and Nixon did. He took the fall. He took the sword. And that's why they could never let him go to jail. After all, if Scooter Libby set foot in a prison, he might just turn on the people who told him to commit treason. So, Bush was willing to let the appeals go on and on and on. And, yeah, all the right-wingers are raising money for him. But as soon as he would step foot in jail, no, have to commute the sentence to $250,000 fine, which he didn't pay a penny of. All his right-wing allies did. I'm sure Bush got the money more quickly than Nixon got his hush money. But now it seems likely, I fear, that Bush will do a full pardon. But the question is how far he'll go. He can constitutionally pardon Dick Cheney prior to Cheney being charged. After all, Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, an unindicted co-conspirator in the Watergate case, because Ford had reason to believe that Nixon would be indicted and sent to jail, and he pardoned him before that even happened. So it is possible. But I actually don't think Bush will do it, because I think to do so, even though if he did so, he would say, well, you know, I don't think it's necessary, but I'll just do it to be safe. To do so is an admission that Bush recognizes that Cheney has committed felonies, or is likely to be charged with them. So I hope he doesn't. And I hope Patrick Fitzgerald continues around and goes after Dick Cheney. Nah, it's probably not likely. But, you know, I think Fitzgerald is kind of angling. I think one of the reasons why he is putting such pressure on Blagojevich, it was, I think, a present to Barack Obama. Getting rid of a governor that Barack Obama did not like very much, and frankly, exonerating Obama in the process. I think it's likely that Obama may turn around and continue to appoint Patrick Fitzgerald. Will he go after Cheney? I hope so. Will he go after President Bush? I hope so. Could President Bush pardon himself? A lot of people ask me this question. It's a great constitutional question. I wish I could give an answer. The only answer I can give is that no president in all of American history has ever pardoned himself. And I just don't think even this Supreme Court would allow it. But I don't know. You can make an argument for it. It is a federal crime. I just hope that all of the crimes that this administration has done over the past 8 years won't go away with the end of their administration. We'll see who Bush pardons. And before I go today, I want to tell you about a constitutional amendment that my ex-boss, Congressman Barney Frank, proposed at the end of the Clinton era when he had all those controversial pardons, when President Clinton did. Barney Frank proposed a constitutional amendment to say that after a presidential election, when a president will no longer be in office, in that small two-month period between the first Tuesday in November until January 20th, not when a president's reelected, but when a president will be leaving office, that the lame duck president loses his power to pardon. Now, I don't support constitutional amendments very often. I think they should only be done in extraordinary circumstances. But I think if we learn from Clinton in the past, and what I fear is going to happen with George Bush over the next 40 days, I think it's a very wise amendment. If the president wants to pardon someone, he can do so, but he has to do so prior to a national election when he can suffer the consequences. Maybe this is an amendment we can get through in the next Congress. Well, I hope you enjoyed the show today. If you have a comment on anything I've said, you know what to do. Just go to RadioInsideScoop.com. Say whatever you will. Have a wonderful weekend. This is Mark Levine, signing off.